If firefighting conjures up images for you of shiny red trucks, men dressed in stiff, thick coats and wearing hard hats that resemble a less tweedy Sherlock Holmes, a Dalmatian dog up front pointing the way to the fire, and all the latest in firefighting paraphernalia, you'd be disappointed when you saw the Chena Goldstream Volunteer Fire Department. If instead you liked a more funky down-home style, then you'd be delighted. No Dalmatians and fancy gear here, but an old truck with flaking school bus yellow paint, bearing a water tank on the back that sloshes out water whenever the truck moves, a rather spiffy-looking ambulance recently purchased from the city for a dollar, and a relaxed, enthusiastic crew headed by Chief Charlie Lundfeld. Even the fire station, located nearly 15 miles from downtown Fairbanks in the Goldstream Valley, looks like it could serve equally well for a barn dance as for a fire station. The department was first organized about 4 years ago, but not much was going on until last December. The station itself has been up for less than 2 months. Rather than being strictly volunteer, there are 6 paid staff members through CETA funds. Chief Lundfeld is charged with finding additional funding to, as he says, keep the department alive. As well as fighting fires in an area not otherwise receiving fire protection, ambulance and emergency medical services are also provided. Before the establishment of the Chena Goldstream Department, homeowners in the area received no firefighting assistance, and says Lundfeld,
the fire loss was 100% in each case. Anytime a house caught fire, it simply burned to the ground. There was nothing to be done out here.
Picnics, raffles, baseball games, and potlucks were held to raise money for the fledgling department. Though some money was obtained, the operation was started and runs on a shoestring.
Up until recently, for instance, anybody who drove the truck to the fire and drove it back had to gas it up out of his own pocket. Most of the equipment here has been donated or purchased for a dollar, just sort of a circulation of used equipment. When the Air Force or the Army or some of the outlying departments get ready to junk some of their equipment, they usually give us a call first before they haul it to the scrapyard.
According to Lundfeld, there are approximately 15,000 fire departments in the United States, and 14,000 of those are volunteer. In the Fairbanks area, there are 4 volunteer or combination paid volunteer departments, plus others in Delta, Healy, and Nenana. One problem with such a system is the level of training of staff and maintaining that level. Training for the Chena Goldstream staffers occurs on a weekly basis, but even people who are unable to attend the required training are able to participate.
People are generally encouraged, if they're not interested in total commitment to firefighting or something, to assist and to help out. So we do have quite a few people who will come out to a fire and generally hold the crowds back or try to assist with the equipment or something like that.
There are currently nearly 35 non-paid trained firefighters and close to 10 emergency medical services state-certified volunteers. Though that reflects a lot of community interest, that same interest can also create problems.
We're getting, as far as volunteers, we're getting more people than we anticipated, and it's going to be difficult to try to keep a handle on them. A lot of people are not as interested in showing up for training as they are in showing up for a fire, and it's hard to make sure we don't have too many new faces there and get them enrolled and get them trained properly like they should be.
What kinds of people show up for training, or is it a real mix?
We've got a variety, all right. I probably ought to leave it at that.
Contributing to that variety is the large number of women in the department, approximately half of the personnel.
Some of not only our best firefighters, but probably some of our most highly trained and competent firefighter women at this point.
Though the notion of fighting fires has a certain glamour and a lot of hard work, most of the calls received by the department are for ambulance service. Frank Nolan is the chief medic.
Well, in 18 days, we've had 21 calls.
Unlike private ambulance firms, the Chena Goldstreamers will pick someone up regardless of their ability to pay for the service. They do, however, hope to break even eventually.
If somebody needs the service, they'll get the service, and we'll talk about the billing later. I mean, that's the policy.
People needn't pay for firefighting services either, though some people do make contributions. Chief Lundfeld describes some of them.
Well, in the case of one individual in the area, with the construction of the station, his particular insurance rates went down by $130, so he donated that difference to the department. In the case of another individual that lost his house, part of the loss was due to the fact that our equipment is so old and antique, and he felt so sorry for us that he donated a pump and hoped we could get some better equipment online.
What does Lundfeld feel is the appeal of a largely volunteer fire department?
The appeal right now is that we can perhaps develop a volunteer system that will help the taxpayers out, cut the cost of homeowners insurance by as much as possible, and hopefully this will be the beginning of the appeal. Secondly, that we hope to make it a sort of a community spirit and a community function where it's very much a social organization as well. People really enjoy coming down, not only for the training, but for a lot of the benefit dances and the ice cream socials and all that old-fashioned stuff that they used to do, and we encourage that a lot. This new building we have here is open for this sort of activity. We're going to be holding benefit dances here as well as all that kind of stuff. Anything from weddings to bar mitzvahs, we'll hold them here.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Was a sunny day, not a cloud was in the sky, not a negative word was heard from the people's passing by.
The weather may not be too terrific in some parts of the state, but in Fairbanks, it's positively time for lying in the backyard in a hammock, the radio on, and book or whatever in hand. There was a record high yesterday of 59 degrees Fahrenheit, a good deal above the normal high of 37, and the overnight low didn't even get down to freezing. Gardens that are usually covered with at least a light layer of snow by now are still showing some hardy heads of cabbage. Weather Service predictions for today call for a continuation of the unseasonably pleasant trend.
Forecast for Fairbanks and vicinity: partly cloudy this morning, some increase in cloudiness this afternoon with a chance of a few sprinkles. The high today will be in the mid-50s. Partial clearing tonight with the low in the upper 20s. Increasing cloudiness and cooler Friday with some light rain in the afternoon. The high Friday will be in the upper 40s. The outlook for Saturday, clearing.
Doug Botner, a meteorologist intern with the Weather Bureau, says the reason we're having such nice weather is that
basically it's just we're getting southerly winds and off the ocean, and it's warmer there, so it's unusually warm here. This is basically the same type of weather pattern that we're having now is the same type as we had last year, which produced the abnormally warm temperatures at that time also.
Botner said that it isn't possible to predict whether the weather reflects a general warming trend.
As many people as you talk to, that's how many different theories you'll have about why the climate is as it is.
And his own predictions? He wouldn't speculate beyond 5 days, but admitted that the forecast continues to call for the temperatures to be above normal.
'Twas a sunny day.
Karen McPherson in balmy Fairbanks.
All the birdies in the trees, and the radio singing song, all the favorite melodies.
In the summer of 1976, died. He had spent his life on the Keokuk River, living in the old way. He was well known for his stories, his philosophy, his songs, and his snowshoe making. 2 years before he died, some of his stories were recorded by the Alaska Native Oral Literature Project. Eliza Jones of the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks has recently been transcribing and translating those tapes. Tapes of stories of times past as told by her uncle. Chief Henry was Eliza's mother's cousin, and his wife Bessie is her father's older sister. Although originally chief at the village of Allakaket, Chief Henry was referred to as chief for the rest of his life. The January following the summer of his death, a memorial potlatch was held for him in Huslia, one of the biggest potlatches in memory. The stories in Eliza's book are of old times recalled by her uncle, who was born in 1883. Eliza herself grew up hearing those stories.
When I was a child, I was real small then, and there was, you know, I had a lot of uncles and aunties from my mom's side and my dad's side, and they were the oldest couple of all my uncle and aunties, so they were always my favorite uncle and aunties because they lived so differently from everybody else, you know. Everybody else liked to, you know, use kicker boats and, you know, do things the easy way. And you used to go to visit them in fish camp, and they had this smokehouse with birch bark covered, and they had a dirt over it, and they'd sit under the smokehouse and tell stories, and I used to just love that.
There's a Cayucan term for the kind of stories in the book.
Mm-hmm. There are kadons idni, and kadons idni are stories about when animals were people, and these were and those are called kadons idni, and those are only stories that are only told a certain time of the year, like, you know, you tell it in maybe starting September to about the end of December. But these stories that I'm working on are called Yudon Hoknaga, which is a sort of like, I guess you'd call it history, you know, which is just words about long time ago, what life was like long time ago.
And could they be told at any time?
And they could be told anytime. Anytime people get together, they start telling stories. You know, you remember what this was like? And, you know, or they tell other stories of events that they'd heard about.
Could you tell us one of those stories?
Yeah. Du oda kun salno. Iet halte yo. Denat og el kikt zohyan. Hokha halte zonal. Another time, we went hunting on a nomadic hunt. At that time, as we moved, all that we had to live on was what others gave us. Their grandfather, now deceased, would try to get spruce hens, but always it was with just one, that he met them at the camp. So, let me try getting the spruce hens too, I said to him. And okay, he said. So I went, to my surprise. So I went to where there was a stand of spruce trees. It was a place where there were lots of spruce hens. And there I shot and shot at the spruce hens. And then really it was too much. So with my belt I tied the necks together and carried the whole bundle. But it was hopeless. And then I remembered that in the summertime, my late uncles, when they hunt, they'd skewer the ducks through the wing. So then with what? Maybe I had an old knife or a piece of tin. With that, I cut a stick and peeled it and skewered the wings with it.
Then I'll stool. So, blood was that. So, eat a bit. Bits and auto dalstly.
Do you think that people will be getting real information from these stories and learning some of the old ways?
Oh, I think so. They just had to. I mean, there's just so much information in here that you can't get by just asking people. And as I'm translating and writing these stories, I also put a footnotes in them to give a background information about some of the things that he's talking about.
The footnotes come from your own understanding of what he's saying?
Yeah, my own. The footnotes come from my own interpretation of the way I understand things. Mm-hmm. And maybe other people would interpret it some other things some other place, but just have to settle with what I got there.
Well, it's the kind of thing that only someone who's been involved with the people, I would think, like with your uncle,
mm-hmm.
could really do.
Mm-hmm. Like some of the things he talked about, there was one part where he talked about bear hunting, and he was talking about when he went trapping, and he said something about I decided to look around in the woods that day, he said, and the way he said it was, I spent the whole day in what looked like a really good ground, good country.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see anything. Even though later on in years, I was to have good luck in finding, you know, what kind of place, and that was the whole thing.
That's the message.
That's the message. I mean, that was all that he said in there, and so I footnoted it, that you know, it's you're not supposed to mention bear or anything like that. So that's.
That's what happened.
So that's what happened, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so by saying, you know, what kind of place, he meant, you know, a bear den, you know, what kind of sign, you know. And
uh-huh.
So there's a lot of that kind of thing in here. And also, you know, he's a lot of things he's talking about, he's taken for granted that other people you know, are supposed to know, you know, so.
Do you think there's a real difference when you take a, something that's oral, like storytelling, and write it down?
Yeah, there is. By writing it down, you lose some of the things, I think, because that's the reason this book is written this way, because the first time that I wrote it, you know, I just wrote it down sentence by sentence and wrote a whole book. But then the way this this one is written now, see, each time he paused is one line. So that if you read it like that, it brings out, it's sort of a poetry style more than...
In prose.
Uh-huh, in prose. Mm-hmm. And the English is sort of compromised between a literal translation and a really good English. So the way it's told in Koyukon is just the opposite from English. The most important event, the most important thing about what you're saying, you say it last.
How do you feel about doing this project? How does it make you feel?
Well, I'm really excited about it. It's one of my favorite projects, and I really enjoy doing this kind of things, that, you know, working on stories and things that other people have told.
You a storyteller yourself?
Well, not very good one.
Eliza Jones, who's working on a book of stories told by a good storyteller, her uncle, Chief Henry. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. You have a problem with the state agency. Say you wanted to apply for a job, went to the office to hand in your resume, only to be told that the job was already filled. But, you protest, the job is still listed as available. It's not yet past the closing date for applications. Receiving no satisfaction there and feeling that something not quite right has happened, where can you go for help? Is there any recourse? Yes, there is. You can write, go in person, or call the nearest office of the Ombudsman. There are offices in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. The state legislature created the office in 1975. In Fairbanks, the Ombudsman representative is Sheila Goderer, a position she has held since January of 1979. In those 10 months, her office has received nearly 800 complaints, most of them from Fairbanks, others from outlying areas. We spoke recently about the job of an Ombudsman's representative.
An Ombudsman, literally translated, means in behalf of mankind. And I suppose you could say what the Ombudsman does for mankind is to make government work for individuals, for the people. Essentially, we are a fact finder. Our main objective is to investigate complaints that people bring us about or against state agencies.
And what happens with these investigations? Where do they go?
Okay, once we have completed an investigation, we make a finding, and then a report is written to the agency. They have a certain amount of time in which to respond to us. Once they respond, we hope they follow our recommendations. If they, most times agencies do, they're cooperative, but there are times when they don't.
And they don't have to under legislation.
No, we cannot enforce our recommendations. However, if we feel strongly enough about a specific recommendation that an agency does not want to follow, we have various options. We can go to the legislature, we can go to the governor, we can, as has been necessary once before, go to the grand jury. But these kinds of things rarely happen.
Let's talk about some of the cases that you've had and how you've dealt with them.
One of the first complaints that I investigated was at the university. It was a case of alleged unfair hiring procedures. Our office investigated that. And as a result of it, we found that interviews were not properly conducted and there were inadequate records maintained. And as a result of our recommendations, they did say they would go ahead and keep their records much more orderly.
But did the person coming to you subsequently get hired for the position?
No, and that's interesting because when he came to me, it was on the last day of it was the closing date of the particular job. And he came to our office and said, I really don't want the job. He said, but I think that what has happened is unfair. He went in on the closing date, he gave in his application, and he was told the person had already been hired. And he said, well, I don't really care about getting hired for that position. He said, but I think something should be done that should not happen again. And obviously he was right in that case. Most of our investigations are not the kinds of investigations that, you know, that hit the paper that are the big ones. They're the everyday kinds of things, people who have problems with unemployment, with public assistance.
What's the bulk of your caseload? What kinds of cases?
Health and Social Services, Natural Resources, Department of Labor. And that's especially true because naturally there's the most amount of interaction between the public. It's a larger mm-hmm. agency.
Have you found it difficult, especially when you were beginning, to indicate to agencies that you, in fact, were a person who had the right to make these investigations and the suggestions?
Yes, I think it's a matter of education. People, depending on where they're at and what's happening, will be threatened, and that's understandable. But I think the more they get to know our office and realize we're not a big ogre and we're not a predator, we're kind of a watchdog, which hopefully is more positive than, you know, negative, then they will answer the phone in a much more positive way and realize that, you know, if they are not going to give us the information, we do have subpoena power, which we don't like to use and which we don't use very often. But legislatively speaking, that's the support mm-hmm. that we have.
How do you personally feel in your role?
Frustrated, challenged, and the feeling that, you know, that as an office, we can make a change to help people better utilize government. It's interesting because as far as the types of complaints that we get and the findings that we come up with, it's not, you know, the complainant is always right. It's about 35% the complaint is justified, 35% the agency, the complaint is unsupported. Mm-hmm. So it's always being very careful that I am as objective as is humanly possible. And sometimes, you know, that's difficult, but I have to keep saying to myself, you're neutral, you're objective, and that's important.
Sheila Goderer, Ombudsman Representative in Fairbanks. I'm Karen McPherson. According to Fish and Wildlife reports, unusually high levels of toxic chemicals have been found in fish and birds in the interior. These contaminants include PCB and DDE. PCB, a federally banned substance, could have come from a number of areas in the Tanana River drainage, including construction sites, military testing grounds, and the hydraulic fluid in old cars seen along the riverbank and used to retard bank erosion. DDE is a derivative of the pesticide DDT, once widely used by the Army at Fort Greely, south of Delta Junction. Both PCB and DDE have cumulative effects in the environment. So a fish, which may live for more than 15 years, can build up a considerable amount of the contaminants. Salmon, the staple of commercial and subsistence fishing activity in the interior, is considered the least tolerant to pesticides of any fish. However, according to Howard Metzger, a project supervisor for the Environmental Conservation and Evaluation Program of the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife in Anchorage, salmon are not likely to be affected because they migrate. He said, quote, "The chance of them becoming infected is very remote." However, other species of fish may not fare so well. In 1978, 14 of 22 fish checked in the Tanana River drainage, primarily grayling, contained DDE, and 13 of the 22 also had PCB. And that wasn't the worst year on record. In 1977, the level of PCB was even higher, high enough that the fish weren't considered safe for human consumption. But why, I asked Metzger, wasn't anybody informed before? Quote, "I can't answer that one," he said, and continued to say that, quote, "If it had appeared to be a level that would have caused a problem to human health, we would make the information available immediately," unquote. The contaminants were, quote, "not at levels where we needed to become overly concerned for fish and wildlife survival, or humans as far as health is concerned. We don't get into the health business. Fish and wildlife is not in that business," unquote. But if you've got grayling left in your freezer from previous years, you might consider a moment before putting the fat and the fish into the fire. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last week denied a request by the state of Alaska to reconsider a decision on the pressure of a gas pipeline, a decision that may make it infeasible to develop a major gas-based petrochemical industry in the interior. According to state officials and experts in the field, the pressure, 1,260 pounds per inch, is too low to allow the $2 billion gas conditioning plant to be built anywhere but at Prudhoe Bay. However, Northwest Alaskan Pipeline Company officials claim that even if the conditioning plant is at Prudhoe Bay, there would still be enough gas liquids available for a sizable petrochemical plant in the Fairbanks area. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor John Carlson, who was in Anchorage yesterday at a hearing of the Alaska Royalty Oil and Gas Development Advisory Board, concurs that the FERC decision on pipeline pressure and the likelihood of a conditioning plant up north does not entirely preclude petrochemical activity in the interior, though perhaps on a smaller scale than he and others had hoped.
Should the conditioning plant be built on the slope, we still have the opportunity for a stripping plant or a small petrochemical plant here in interior Alaska. So this does not forego some type of development here, plus the opportunity to get gas for local use, for industry and for home heating.
Carlson estimated that such a facility would employ approximately 100 people, comparable in number to the North Pole refinery operation. But he acknowledges that the Fairbanks area isn't the only possible location for petrochemical processing facilities.
There are several areas that can be and would be viable in interior Alaska, or in Alaska, I should say, as a petrochemical industry here. So these are things that will have to be worked on and find the companies that are interested in developing this.
Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor John Carlson. I'm Karen McPherson.
The 1980 itself specifically, will be the decision year of this nation as far as what direction we're going.
That's Representative Don Young in a presentation before the Farthest North Press Club in Fairbanks last Friday. According to Young, the options for the 1980s are limited.
Either we're going to continue the direction and improve upon the system which we've lived under, who has given us the greatest standard of living that any nation has ever experienced, or we're going to go into the other direction. That's the direction of zero growth, regression, and frankly, a great deal of lowering the standard of living.
Young cautioned that if the United States did not develop its own resources, as the nation has done historically, we would be hovering on the edge of
the beginning of regression. Now, I know there's going to be some objections to this philosophy which I speak of. We don't need to grow, we don't need to change, and we'll stand stationary. That is the utopia of one selfish interest. It is not reality. And I truly believe that if this nation doesn't turn in the 1980s, and back to the idea that, yes, there is a way the individual can improve upon his life, yes, there is a way that we have a responsibility to the nation to secure peace and freedom, then, frankly, we'll go into another system of government. And that system, my good friends, will be socialist.
He fears that some of the potential presidential candidates and current members of Congress may be inclined toward that end and has polled a number of presidential hopefuls for their views. Thus far, three of the respondents, Ronald Reagan, John Connally, and George Bush, have replied in a manner favorable to Young. They evidently share his view that heavy resource development is the direction the nation should take. Having announced his intention not to run against Mike Gravel for Senate, Young expects to be involved in the fight for increased development of hydroelectric power, petrochemicals, mining, timber, fisheries, and tourism from the House, pending, of course, his reelection. Why stay in Congress? Because he says, quote, I love being the only congressman. He enjoys his seniority and further.
I enjoy the volatility, or what do you call it, the excitement of the House.
Well, the way Young's talking now, he'll certainly be adding to that, what do you call it? Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.